my head. Ooh, baby, it's a long way down to the bottom of the river. Hold my head. Ooh, baby, it's a long way down, a long way down. If you get sleep or if you get night,
the cock's gonna call in the morning, baby.
And check the cupboard for your daddy's gun.
Red sun rises like an early warning.
The Lord's gonna come for your firstborn son.
His hair's on fire and his heart is burning.
So go to the river where the water runs.
Wash him deep where the tides are turning.
And if you fall, and if you fall, hold my hand. Ooh, baby, it's a long way down to the bottom of the river. Hold my hand. Ooh, baby, it's a long way down, a long way down. The wolves will chase you by the pale moonlight.
Drunk and driven by a terrible song, girl.
The time is now 2:03 p.m. You're listening to 91.5 WMFO Medford, Tufts Free Form Radio. This is Academics on Air. Our co-host Marissa will be here shortly, but we have our guest Judy. But yeah, before we get into it, we're just going to play some songs and then we'll get into the discussion and the reading, so stay tuned.
Down for whatever I think I let go. Hey, welcome to Academics on Air. This is Marissa.
And this is Jenna. And today our guest is Judy. Judy is an anthropology major and you are science, technology, and society minor. Yeah. So she'll be joining us today in our to continue our anthropological theme that we seem to have had the past couple weeks.
Once again, we do invite all types of folks, all interests to this. It's not anthropology exclusive. So if you'd like to be a guest and if you have an interesting academic article or passage to share, please email us to get involved at academicsonair@gmail.com.
Yes, we'd love to hear from you. Anthropology and non-anthropology alike. So Judy, do you mind introducing yourself for us and our listeners?
Okay. Hello, my name is Judy. Jenna did a pretty good, solid intro. I am an anthro major. I am an STS minor. I am a senior, and I am also working on a thesis in anthropology this year. So my mind is very anthroed out this year and last year, but anthroed out in the best way possible, because I fell into anthropology by accident, fell in love with it, and have had many good readings out of it. So I'll be reading something from one of these classes.
Yeah. So I think we're going to play a quick song and then we're going to jump right into the reading. So stay tuned. Patti LaBelle, Lady Marmalade, and now we're going to have Judy introduce and read the piece.
Okay. Hi. So the piece that I will be reading is a piece called Anger, Economy, and Female Agency, Problematizing Prostitution and Sex Work Among the Huli of Papua New Guinea. was a piece that was written in the summer of, well, that was published 2004 by Holly Wardlow. And I read this piece last semester for my class called Sex and Money, Anthropology of Sex Work, taught by Professor Sarah Luna at the Department of Anthropology. I was also across the class with WGSS, which is Women, Gender, Sexuality Studies. This was a piece that is talking about the Huli passenger women of Papua New Guinea. So in this piece, they're very intentional about not calling the passenger women prostitutes. They were engaged in some sort. So it's really problematizing. What do we call prostitution and what do we call sex work? And what really struck me about this piece was the different kinds of motivations that these women went into quote-unquote sex work with. So it is a 25-page long piece. So I'll read the part that is talking about money, motivation, and causality. So the section begins with, when one turns to the question of causation and motivation, here too, Huli passenger women do not fit easily into Western constructions of prostitution. Most social science research, whether in Western or non-Western context, stresses either economic desperation or the awareness that sex work potentially pays better than other service work usually done by women. As Maggie O'Neill puts it, the bottom line for entry into prostitution is economic need. However, neither I nor most Huli nor self-identified passenger women would assert that passenger women are motivated by economic necessity. Only 3 of the 18 passenger women I interviewed cited money as the reason they engaged in monetized sexual exchanges. Moreover, not a single woman I spoke with said that she had ever demanded a specific amount of money from a man. Indeed, it is a point of pride for many women that they do not demand money and that instead men offer it to them. According to many passenger women, when a man offers money for sex, this shows that he is so consumed by desire that he has overcome his fear that women and their vaginas are dangerous. Desire has made him abandon the self-discipline that defines masculinity. To get a man to offer money is to vanquish him. Thus, according to passenger women, if anyone's integrity is damaged by the exchange of money for sex, it is men's. This attitude of passenger women toward money problematizes the intellectual and strategic step of replacing the term prostitution with that of sex work. While the category of sex work fruitfully invites approaches that focus on labor issues rather than on moral status, it can be critiqued as the compulsion to salvage women's morality by labeling what they do as work, an activity that in the West is inherently virtuous and that is associated with industriousness, productivity, efficiency, and so forth. In other words, according to our Protestant ethic, work is always a saving grace. If the woman is engaged in work, even if it is on her back, then it must be okay. So I'll pause there. That's the section. There's more stuff about how they are driven by anger and resistance rather than by money. So a little bit of context before that is most of the passenger women who entered sex work, they did it after acts of trauma, so after being raped or after being abused by their family members and relatives, and so they engage in, they become passenger women as a way to escape that as a way to claim some sort of freedom.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I guess one thing that really struck out for me from the passage was kind of like, in terms of like who is asking for like compensation, or not necessarily compensation, but money, it's like they're putting it, I guess, in the hands of the men, kind of, or it's just like it's up to the men to then, you know, do that monetary transaction. Does that make, I just thought that was interesting in terms of like comparison with like Western culture. And how we know, like, oh, it's like you usually, like, you, at least from what I've seen in, you know, TV shows and movies, like, you pay for it up front. It's like there's a set fee for, like, you know, depending on what type of services you're asking for and such.
Thank you for reading this, Judy. Can you remind me, if you already said it, I'm not sure, when was this research done, or and exactly where is it coming from?
So this was published in 2004. I'm not sure where the field work was, when the field work was done, and this was in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, I'm curious, Jenna, along the lines of your question, like just the vast differences in what prostitution looks like across the world.
Yeah, do you recall any, I guess, were there any like specific other comparisons between like our Western conceptualization versus how these passenger women in Papua New Guinea kind of experience or kind of like make this work into their own kind of form? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think part of that is also, you know, is what they're doing work?
Yeah, I think yeah, that was definitely a big question that was raised by the author there.
Yeah, and I think what struck me was it was contextualizing this in, you know, part of that resistance was also so bride wealth is a big thing, and so it's organized, you know, bride wealth organized by kin, and so usually when they left their groups to engage in, for lack of a better word, I'd say passenger womanhood, it's driven, say, you know, they experienced rape, but they would find the anger came from the fact of the rape, but also the fact that no one in their family was standing up to them, no one in the family would do anything about it. And part of that was because, you know, if you are raped, then your value as bride wealth, your value as a woman that can then be married off to get bride wealth, that gets lowered. And so you have no longer, you know, you don't really bring the same amount of value to these families, their own families. And so in that sense, the kind of being bride, you know, being exchanged for bride wealth is work. And I guess that's how I kind of understood it in an interesting way. And so going to quote unquote sex work was a subversion of the work that was imposed on their own bodies by just the cultural standards of marriage and the value of womanhood, I guess.
That's really interesting. It feels like if you're looking at an exchange for bride wealth as work, but like work with less agency or less choice for the bride, it's the subverting of it into being a passenger woman. Like that does that hold more agency, do you think?
I think in some cases yes, and in class I remember we were talking about this thing called, you know, of negative agency, of how becoming passenger woman, it is also stigmatized, and so it carries that too, and you know, they presumably, it doesn't talk a lot about it in the reading, but presumably they can't go back to their families, and so in that case there are a lot of ramifications that are negative, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no sense of agency. And I think another case of that is in the cases where they left their families into passenger womanhood because of violence, domestic violence, for example. Entering passenger womanhood, you've practically destroyed your value of being married off. Mm-hmm. So you've destroyed that income stream for your family. And so there's also that part that you're destroying your
like burning a bridge in a certain way.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, I don't know if it was mentioned at the beginning of the article and I just missed it, but could you explain like passenger womanhood and just in terms of like what that means?
Yeah. I don't want to use the word sex work because the whole and I don't think the
I'm just kind of like curious what, so that's a word, a label, or yeah, that she's using, like what is I guess the context of that, like is it like why passenger?
I imagine I can find something that talks about it.
We can also come back to that.
Yeah,
if you need to look.
Yeah. Maybe this is a good spot where maybe we'll play a song and then we'll get back with our listeners about the context of the word and other interesting thoughts about the article. So yeah, stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Academics on Air. We have a quick PSA before we return to our regularly scheduled programming. So the annual worldwide economy is about $70 trillion. Does that make sense? Yes. The U.S. gross domestic product is the largest of any single country at $15 trillion, followed by China's $7 trillion GDP. These numbers are also from, 2010, so that might be a little out of date. With the United States comprising slightly less than 5% of the world's population and 5% of Americans accounting for half of the $2.5 trillion annually spent in the U.S. on healthcare, that means that 2% of the world's economy is devoted to just the medical costs of 0.25%. That's 0.25% of the planet's population. These are some numbers to think about from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And so before our quick music break, we were kind of thinking about what does it mean to be a passenger woman? And so I think Judy has some context she can provide for us.
Yeah, so I'll share what Wardlow means when she's talking about hooey passenger women, and I'll actually give a really brief example of one. So she included two case studies here. So Wardlow says, it is difficult to find a word that captures all the meanings of the term passenger woman, but I've often glossed it as incipient prostitution. That is, prostitution that is not institutionalized or naturalized as, quote-unquote, the oldest profession. And so she also continues by saying, among the Huli, the term passenger woman is both a stigmatizing slur directed at women who are believed to engage in sexually illicit behavior, whether it involves money or not, which is relevant in this case, and an identity that some women embrace because it symbolizes rebellion and autonomy. And people who are passenger women, they typically engage with sexual relationships with numerous men, and the exchange of money is not necessarily always a guarantee, but is also there sometimes.
I think the kind of the duality of it, whether it be kind of like a stigmatizing label or one that can be embraced, reminds me of, I don't know if we're allowed to say it on air because it's safe harbor hours, but should I not say it? It starts with an S. It's four letters.
You should not.
Okay, well, I'll just leave it at that, and you can do the math. But that word I think is also kind of has that duality to it, and that, you know, people use it to, I guess, offend or hurt other people, like when you call someone that, but also I've seen women use it to kind of they embrace it, and they like using the label to describe themselves. So I think that's interesting that that's also present with the passenger woman as well.
Of the readings that you did for this class, what stood out about this one? Or, you know, what, why is this something that you chose today?
Yeah, I remember being struck by it when I read it because it really problematized work, really problematized prostitution, and just gave another reading into the kind of agencies that people feel. And I think here a lot of that, maybe kind of what you were talking about, Jenna, is people who go into sex work, and a lot of the moving around it is, you know, sex work is work, it is real labor, which is why it should be legalized or decriminalized or what have you, and being recognized in that way, and saying it, you know, like, it's not anti, you know, and also, like, you know, it's not anti-feminist to, you know, do sex work because it's really empowering, it feels like I'm in control, I have agency, like, it's, there's a lot of discourse around that, you know, and that's present in, I think, prostitution and pornography, and it's a very, it's individually liberating, almost self-actualizing kind of freedom and agency, but in this case it's not, it's contextualized in terms of family, in terms of the local economics, in terms of emotion and revenge almost, and it just kind of twists that on its head a little bit, and I found that to be fascinating. him, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think it does. And thank you. And during the music break, we were talking a little bit about work, because there was also an anthropology class last semester that Judy took at the same time, I guess, as this one, that was focused on work and the end of work. Mm-hmm. And
same as our guest, our previous guest, Celeste.
Yes.
So again, lots of anthropology, but I think it's all, you know, very interesting. I hope our listeners think so too. But yeah, do you want to talk a little bit more about that conversation? Or,
well, a question I have relating to, so a little bit of context for this question. Yesterday I was at a conference that was an environmental justice conference focused on food justice, but also, you know, taking into account all parts of food systems and labor in food service as a part of that, and labor in like farm workers and things like that, and learning things that I didn't know about minimum wage laws that, and so this, I promise this will wrap back around, but so for example, the minimum wage in Massachusetts right now is $12 per hour, and the minimum wage for farm workers is about $8 an hour. Hmm. And so that's one, it's called a sub-minimum wage. And actually for...
Are they allowed to kind of do that and like kind of like say some workers are allowed to,
I think,
be paid,
I believe,
less?
It's written into legislation, okay, that there are types of work that don't fall into the same category of general minimum wage. And mm-hmm. So farm workers is one example of that. And then restaurant workers is another example of that, which is common across almost all states, that there's a sub-minimum wage that servers in a restaurant will make. In Massachusetts, it's $4.65 an hour, and then tips are supposed to make up into the minimum wage or above.
So sorry if we're getting a little off topic, I'm just kind of interested. So I guess they're supposed to be able to make it up through tips for service workers, but like, is the same kind of thinking applied to farmers, or it's just like, sorry,
I have no idea why that labor is simply valued at less money, because I don't think that there's any tipping in that industry. So that's a really good question, and I would need to look into it. But then that question of servers, and waiters and waitresses getting a sub-minimum wage and then relying on tips to make up for it, one of the speakers at the conference dived into the history of tipping as a like racist history, where basically there were a lot of quotes and interesting passages from essentially freed slaves being servers at restaurants, and white patrons being like willing to tip these so the freed slaves were like, it was unpaid labor essentially, but then like they would be given tips because there was aspects of inferiority still associated with this, and aspects of like not like it being okay to tip someone who is your inferior, but not being okay to tip or give money voluntarily to someone who was equal, that would feel different. So I was thinking about that related, so thank you for that long explanation letting me have that, but thinking about the first passage that you read where before the explanation of passenger woman, but about the like it not actually being women asking for compensation in some cases, it being men voluntarily doing that, but then like kind of just what it would mean to view that instead of as like a wage or a decided transaction, it being a tip, it being like a very much
like a men viewing women as inferior, and so they're holding, I guess, this kind of like power over them and compensating them.
Maybe, and I don't know the full context of that article, but that's just, I was definitely thinking about the history of types of work that aren't don't have a set wage and have things that are essentially tips and are based on how someone feels about a service.
Yeah.
That was just a thought, if anyone wants to comment on it, not necessarily a question.
I have thoughts about tipping, but not necessarily in the context of sex work. I was just kind of, I don't know, if I don't want to steer the conversation away from that yet, if you have thoughts, Judy, about Marissa's.
I guess I was just thinking about how in some of these women's cases, they didn't ask for money initially because their key motivation was you know, they were angry, and they wanted to take away the ability for their bodies to be used in exchange for bride wealth. And so to do that, it would be to destroy the reputation through illicit sexual behavior. And illicit sexual behavior does not have to be paid necessarily. Mm. And so just by engaging in sex work, that destroys the reputation. You don't need money to do that. And so I think there's a lot of that freedom associated with that. In terms of the men offering women money, there was, I think, in that initial passage, talking about how it was actually the men. So, for example, thus, according to Passenger Woman, if anyone's integrity is damaged by the exchange of money for sex, it's men's. Mm. So why is that? You know, aren't they the one who has the money and the power to pay these women? And the reason is because there's another section in the article that talks about how in Ohuli culture, which sounds very general, the men are the ones that are considered beautiful and desired, whereas the women are the ones that are seen as ugly and smelly, which is the reverse of how sex work is being talked about here. So it's like, okay, so if the men are the desired ones, then why would they want to seek out these, you know, smelly women who have smelly vaginas? And added on to that is the stigma of going with a passenger woman who has ill reputation. And the reason is that some of the motivations that Wardlow talked about was some of these men, they wanted to see these passenger women because they wanted to experiment sexually in ways that their, say, long-time, their significant other wouldn't allow them to, or wouldn't, you know. So in that case, it's also, in that case, it feels like the men is buying the opportunity to engage in illicit behavior, buying the opportunity to experiment, but to a point where they have to overcome the initial disgust they have for these women. And so on the woman's side, it's like, oh, like, you want me enough for you to go over what's social norm and go over your innate disgust, then, you know, I'm in the upper hand.
That's interesting. I don't know how relevant my tipping thoughts were anymore, but I also just had thoughts recently. This, again, might be turning the conversation a little bit, but I'm curious, if either you talked about in class or if you guys have thoughts at all about kind of I'm thinking of like those types of apps or like dating experiences where it's like sugar daddy type things where it's like, it's not like explicitly sex work, I don't think, in the sense, but I feel like sometimes, you know, if you're going on a date with a wealthier man, it's kind of like expected that there will be some sort of sexual compensation for I don't know what you get out of your experience. And I think for the most part, I mean, maybe I'm being too stereotypical in saying that, you know, this is a wealthy man and kind of a young woman who's kind of taking on these opportunities. But that's just how I'm, I guess, choosing to use pronouns and such for now. So I'm not saying it's limited to that, but that I'm just going to go to that default.
Yeah, I only really know that exists, and I think those are interesting. But.
Yeah. In the class, there were people who did, you know, their presentation. You know, they wrote their final papers about precisely these apps. I forget. It's not seeking an arrangement.
I think that's a thing. I don't know if it's like a. No. That's what it's. Explicitly for, but I know I've heard of that as,
yeah.
Like a,
oh, it's I'm blanking on it now, but yeah, there we definitely discussed kind of what it looks like contemporarily, yeah, there's
I mean, this is technically still contemporary though, but I mean what your article talked about, right? Because you said 2004. True. I mean, I know what you mean by that, but I just think it's interesting. No, it's like, I guess it's more contemporary in the sense that we're using like technology to kind of facilitate these relationships, if that's what you want to call them.
No, for sure. I guess I can, relevant to where we are in our youth culture, but I think that's actually a really good point, because it again, kind of going back to the anthro side of things, there's it's called allosynchrony, which is something that, you know, anthropologists classically wrote about things from, so, you know, faraway lands, that it seems far away in geographical distance, but sometimes it's easy to also feel like they're of a different time, mm-hmm. right? That they're they're primitive and they've, you know, just stuck in the past, even though we're all here in the present. And so that's something that I think we've gotten much better at. But I think colloquially, sometimes it's still easy to fall into that trap of like, oh, like, you know, 10 years ago, that's not, that's what, 15 years ago, that's not that far away. But the fact that they are in a faraway land with a very quote-unquote distant culture, which is still very much enmeshed in the other cultures, Papua New Guinea, outside of their tribe, I think. Anyway.
So. Thank you for commenting on that. I think that's really important for listeners who are becoming anthropological scholars at this point to take into consideration. And I think that that is something that has been a very strong theme in most of my anthropology courses is actually, I was kind of surprised that you were reading something from Papua New Guinea, which I know nothing about, in that a lot of my anthro courses have really turned towards you know, not trying to take that like super exterior research perspective that I think, but I almost wonder at times if U.S. university-based anthropology has become too like reflexive or like, I don't know, I just think that there's a lot of interesting, and I say that in the context of having experience studying abroad and taking, I was surprised to find a really awesome anthropology department at the university where I studied abroad, and took two anthro classes there, and I think that there was less of that reflexivity of like, oh, we should maybe do more studies on these topics, but at home. And so I think that it's very different, just conception, the way in which anthropology is changing and conceptions around it are. That wasn't eloquent, I'm sorry.
But I think you're right. Like, I think in that particular class, we look at examples from a lot of different countries and from scholars from different countries, field work from different countries. And so, but I remember the class where we talked about this piece, we began the lecture with two videos, like two tourism videos of Papua New Guinea. And she was just like, this is what people think Papua New Guinea is like. To kind of show, again, the kind of stereotypes we have thinking of Papua New Guinea. And I think just being mindful of that, you know, they are, you know, I mean, there are people, I mean, on the one hand, it's like it's kind of the stereotypical classic site for anthropology fieldwork. But it's a place that exists now with people that live now.
It's not just kind of this like place people go to observe others. And yeah, interesting. Okay, well, I think this might be a good place to play another song if you guys are good with that. All right, we'll be back soon. Enjoy the music.
Those days
You are currently listening to Roxanne. Oops, just ended. And once again, this is Academics on Air, and you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Thank you very much to our guest,
Judy,
today.
Thank you so much for having me ramble.
And I believe that next week we will be moving to a theme of Catholicism. So
yeah, so stay tuned for that. And again, if you're interested in being on our show, you can email us at academicsonair@gmail.com. Again, that's academicsonair@gmail.com. That song was Roxanne by The Police, and we're going to close out with Let's Talk About Sex by Salt and Pepper.
Cut it up one time. Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex.
Well, let's talk about sex for now. To the people at home or in the crowd, it keeps coming up anyhow. Don't decoy, avoid, or make void the topic, cause that ain't gonna stop it. Now we talk about sex on the radio and video shows. Many will know anything goes. Let's tell it like it is and how it could be. How it was and of course how it should be. Those who think it's dirty have a choice. Pick up the needle, press pause, or turn the radio off. Will that stop us, Pep? I doubt it. Alright then, come on, spin.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex.
Make any man's eyes pop. She uses, she got to get whatever she don't got. Fellas droop like fools, but then again, they're only human. The chick was a hit because her body was booming. Gold, pearls, rubies, crazy diamonds. Nothing she wore was ever common. Her dates, heads of state, men of taste, lawyers, doctors. No one was too great for her to get with or even mess with. The press, she says, was next on her list. And believe me, you, it's as good as true. There ain't a man alive that she couldn't get next to. She had it all in the bag. So she should have been glad, but she was mad and sad and feeling bad, thinking about the things that she never had. No love, just sex, followed next with a check and a note. That last night was dope, 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 dope.
Take it easy.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex.
Do it.
Let's talk about sex.
Let's talk about sex.
All right. Yo, Pep, I don't think they they gon' play this on the radio.
And why not? Everybody have sex.
I mean, everybody should be making love.
Come on, how many guys you know make
love? Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's